Now, September 11th, 2001 is one of those defining moments that forever divides history into a before and an after. Over the past decade, we have been routinely reminded of the fact that we are living in a post-9/11 world. One of the aspects of that new reality is just a heightened sense of vulnerability. It wasn't just lives and buildings that were shattered that day. It was a whole sense of security. Up until then, we had lived with this sense. In retrospect, it was undoubtedly an illusionary sense, but we had lived with this sense that we were safe and secure here within our borders, immune from the kind of attack that we saw that day. And so 9/11 represented a profound psychological shift. There were also spiritual issues involved. Any catastrophic event of that magnitude invariably causes us to start wondering, where was God in the middle of all of this? How could God allow something like this to happen? In fact, in the case of that particular event, religion was just an inseparable part of the story because the perpetrators claimed to be acting out of religious motivations. And so there was also just this lingering sense that it might be perceived as a victory for their religious cause and for the God that they claimed to worship. Well, if any of those responses strike a chord with you, rest assured that we are not the first ones to feel that way. We are not the first ones to ask those kind of questions. In fact, those issues and those questions have been posed from time immemorial. They undoubtedly were on the minds of a group of people living some 2,500 years ago. They too, you might say, were victims of Middle East terrorism. They had been terrorized by an invading army from Babylon that had destroyed their homeland of Judah. In the course of that invasion, they had witnessed absolutely unspeakable atrocities, mass starvation, civilian massacres, the mistreatment of prisoners. Their capital city, Jerusalem, had been completely destroyed, and along with it, the beautiful temple that was their spiritual home and the center of their national identity. But not only did these events create untold human suffering, they also triggered a major spiritual crisis. Some of the pillars of their faith had been toppled. You know, before 9/11, those of us who are Americans may have sort of tacitly assumed that we were invulnerable to attack. But for these Jewish people, one of their explicit core convictions was the belief that God would never allow their temple to be destroyed. We see that reflected in some of the books of the Bible that date to the period before the destruction of Jerusalem. People were absolutely convinced it was a rock-solid pillar of their faith that God had caused His name to dwell there in Jerusalem and in their temple, and God would never allow that place to be destroyed. So now what? How could their God, Yahweh, allow this to happen? And you know, people in the ancient world generally believed that a nation's God or gods would always side with them in the context of a battle, a conflict. And so, if your nation was conquered by another nation, it was taken to mean that the gods of that nation must be more powerful than your God. And so, against the backdrop of that mindset, it would obviously be natural to assume that Yahweh must be no match for the gods of the Babylonians. Up until now, all of the things that I have been describing are fairly well substantiated. We know that all of these things took place. We know that people responded in the ways that I have described. But now here's the speculative part, okay? There's no way of proving this, but Bible scholars nowadays generally believe that that creation story from Genesis 1 that we just heard read was written, or at least it achieved its present form, at the time of that exile. And it was written precisely in order to respond to all of those concerns and all of those questions that I have just been laying out for us. To a people living in exile, to a people whose lives had been turned upside down, this creation story came with the word, "Your God is the sovereign creator of the universe, regardless of what else may be going on around you, your God is still in control." That was the message of that story. And one of the reasons that the Bible scholars think that this creation story achieved its present form at the time of the exile is because of the fact that it bears a very striking resemblance to the creation myths that existed among the ancient Babylonians. It has some of the same terminology. It has some of the same imagery. Both of those stories start in the same way with a watery chaos out of which order emerges. But those similarities are not there because the biblical writer simply borrowed their ideas or borrowed myths from the surrounding cultures. You know, that was a popular idea at one point in time. You may have even learned that, you know, 30, 40 years ago in a college course. Well, the biblical writers just borrowed all their ideas from other cultures because, look, you can see these similarities. No, that idea, actually, I think, has been completely debunked. The reason for those similarities is because this story in Genesis was deliberately crafted in order to repudiate those ideas from the Babylonian worldview. The terminology and the imagery may be the same, but the underlying theology, the belief system that was being represented there, is radically different. The mythological worldview, illustrated by the Babylonian story, there are lots and lots of different gods, and none of those gods are necessarily all-powerful. They're struggling between and amongst themselves. By way of contrast, in Genesis chapter 1, the Hebrew God is one God, and that God is completely sovereign. There aren't any signs of conflict or struggle in the Genesis 1 story. In fact, one of the key elements in that Genesis 1 story is what Bible scholars call the command realization formula. Now, that's kind of a mouthful, but what it refers to is that pattern that you see all through the story. And God said, and it was so. And God said, and it was so. And God said, and it was so. That's the pattern throughout the entire story. The whole story is structured around that formula. And that formula is a way of showing a God who is sovereign. It's a way of reminding people living in exile that their God is still in control. Now, this isn't a story in Genesis 1. This isn't a story that is just told in order to satisfy our curiosity about how everything got there. It's not a story that is designed to take the place of scientific inquiry. Genesis 1 isn't a scientific theory. Genesis 1 is a theological assertion. It's a statement about the kind of God people of the Bible worship. He is a God who is sovereign. He is a creating God, a God who can take chaos and confusion and turn it into order and beauty. This is a God who can call light out of darkness. But this story isn't just a theological assertion. This story is a pastoral response to the things that were happening in the world at the time it was written. It's saying to these people whose lives have been turned upside down, God can do the same thing for you. Our God is still in the creation business. Our God is still calling light out of darkness. And one of the other reasons that we believe this creation story dates to the time of the Babylonian exile is because these exact same themes are found in some of the prophetic passages that were that date back to that period. For example, you can go back and read Isaiah 44, 45, 46. These were all passages that were addressed to those Jewish people living in exile, passages that were promising them deliverance and hope and restoration. And if you go back and read those chapters from Isaiah, you see that those promises of hope and restoration and deliverance are all grounded in a theology of creation. Creation is one of the major themes in those exilic period prophetic writings. All of those promises are grounded in what Israel believes about creation. The prophetic writers are saying that God who created the world can also recreate a community of his people even after they have been decimated and scattered. God is still in the creation business. That is the thing that gave hope to people living in an unsettled world, people whose lives had been upset, people living in exile. Genesis 1 offers hope and reassurance to people in exile. But although it offers reassurance and hope, Genesis 1 doesn't necessarily answer all of the questions that we might have. You know, alongside all of the strong claims that it makes, there's also an element of mystery. You know, the creation story begins with the world in a state of chaos. But interestingly, the story never tells us where that chaos came from. Now, there is kind of a humorous explanation that I've heard. It actually comes from a story about a doctor, an engineer, and a lawyer who were arguing over whose profession was the oldest. Well, the doctor said, well, obviously, it's the practice of medicine, because you go all the way back there, story of how human beings were created. God took a rib from the side of the man and used it to form a woman. That is an example of surgery. So obviously, medicine is the oldest profession. The engineer said, but if you go back to the previous chapter, God takes that original state of chaos and gives it order and structure. That is a remarkable engineering feat. The lawyer just smiled and shook his head and said, but where do you think the chaos came from? Well, that is one explanation, but it also raises a key theological question. Where did the chaos come from? We might also wonder, you know, if God created the light, did God also create the darkness? Once again, the story doesn't say. The story does say that God named the darkness and the light. And you know, in the biblical worldview, to name something is to assert control over it. And so light and darkness are equally under God's control. But the text only identifies God as the author of the light. So against the backdrop of those reflections from Genesis chapter 1, we go back to some of our original questions. Where was God on September 11, 2001? We believe that God was doing what God has always been doing since the creation of the universe. The Spirit of God was hovering over the chaos and the confusion and the disorder of that day. God was calling light out of the darkness. God's light, I think, was shining in a multitude of ways that day. I believe that Father Michael Judge was a beacon of God's light that day as the New York City Fire Department chaplain. Father Judge was there in the Twin Towers offering comfort and encouragement to firefighters, many of them going to their deaths just before he himself was killed. Witnesses observed Father Judge just walking, pacing back and forth there in the lobby of one of the Twin Towers. They saw that his lips were constantly moving, and they knew that he was praying. He was praying for rescue workers. He was praying for people who even then were losing their lives. I believe that God's light shone brightly through Abe Zalmanowitz, an Orthodox Jewish person from Brooklyn, working on the 27th floor of Tower 1 that day after the plane struck. He stood there in a landing and watched as thousands and thousands of people streamed by, evacuating the buildings. The firefighters tried to get him to leave as well, but he said, "No, I'm staying with my friend." You see, his friend and co-worker, Ed, was a quadriplegic, confined to a wheelchair. When the other tower fell, even the firefighters evacuated the floor, all except for their captain. Abe and the fire captain stayed, rather than leave Ed behind in that terrifying moment. One of the last survivors to leave the floor thought that they were praying together. They died there when the second tower fell. And I think sometimes God's light shines most brightly when the darkness is the most impenetrable. Now, God sent me a little reminder of that fact on the night of September 11th. I had a full day of meetings and appointments that day all the way up into the night. I was listening to the news on National Public Radio as I drove around, but I didn't really absorb the full impact of what had happened until I got back to my office late that night. I started reading the news reports on the New York Times website, and it was only as I was reading the news stories and seeing the photographs that the full magnitude of it finally hit home with me. I was in just total shock and disbelief as I left the church and began walking the two blocks back to my apartment. There happened to be another church right across the alleyway from mine, and as I passed by on the steps of this other church's parsonage, there was a teenage girl clutching a lit candle. The flickering flame was piercing the darkness of that darkest of nights. And suddenly it hit me. Even in the darkest moments, even in the darkest moments of our lives, even in the darkest moments of history, God is still there, calling forth the light. The light shines in the darkness. the gospel writer John says, and the darkness can never overcome it. Thanks be to God. Amen.